Toast.
Toast.
Right here. Right now. Most important thing in life will always be the
Movie Squad.
Salute me, familia.
Welcome to the Movie Squad podcast. My name is Tristan Fidler.
And my name is Simon Morato.
This is an official RTRFM podcast where we share our weekly edition of Movie Chat, as heard on Breakfast with Taylor every Friday morning, 7:30 a.m. on RTRFM 92.1. And we cover major cinematic releases from Hollywood. We also cover releases closer to home and the independent art house field. And this episode is a good, I think, balance between the two, with a few little connections possibly across them. But I think, you know, a big part of this episode will be an interview that I did with the director, Alena Lodkina, of a new film, Petrol. And I was really excited to talk to her about it, because this film is one to think about, definitely, and definitely after you've seen it and the days after it as well.
Yes, and you review Petrol in the second half of today's episode. I'm very excited to listen to the full 30-minute interview after that, because it's the perfect kind of movie to, you know, sit with for a little bit and then go, all right, let's dig a little bit deeper once you've made up your own mind, and then see where that takes you. But first, Tristan, we have some mucky business to get to, and that is the new Hollywood blockbuster Renfield, starring Nicolas Cage as Dracula and Nicholas Hoult as his devoted servant, familiar, slave, Renfield, the title character, if you will.
Yeah, and one that I was actually looking forward to because, you know, Nicolas Cage, well, he played a would-be vampire in one of his most famous performances, in my mind anyway, Vampire's Kiss.
Famous bug-eating in that movie.
Yes.
Lots of bug-eating in this one.
That's right. Though I think it's been discussed that, yeah, I don't think there were real bugs in this one as compared to the film from the 80s. But, yeah, I was reading an interview where it was like Nicolas Cage was talking about the roles that he had dreamed about playing, and they were like Superman, Captain Nemo, and Dracula. So here we have Nicolas Cage as Dracula with Nicholas Hoult in Renfield.
Sorry to interrupt.
Are you okay?
I need to get out of a toxic relationship.
Why don't you start by telling us what brought you here?
My boss, he's different.
You can't get him out of your head.
No.
I need your assistance.
I'm coming, Master!
Oh, you feel like he could destroy you with the snap of his fingers?
Wouldn't even need to snap.
Okay.
Uh-huh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, what?
It is 7:30. It is your Friday morning. Time to check in with the squad. It is Movie Squad, and back again this week. Simon, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Very good. Tristan, it's nice to see you again.
It is great to see you again as well, Taylor.
Feeling very disappointed I wasn't here for Fast and the Furious week, folks.
Oh, have you seen Fast X yet?
I haven't.
Oh, well. Simon, have you?
No, I've not caught up with it in the last week, unfortunately. Had a couple other movies to get in front of it. But it's an interesting one because it hasn't done hugely at the box office.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's meant to be one of those guaranteed franchises. And what you were suggesting in your review, Tristan, was it last week or the week before? It's all blur.
No, it was the other week. But yeah, like you know, it'll make money, but will it be enough money for the producers to sign off on Vin Diesel's wacky plan of not just number 11, but number 12 as well?
Hang on. This was meant to be the last one.
No.
Taylor.
I was like, it's all right if it's not a box office smash. It can be a slow burn because there's not going to be another one.
Taylor.
Oh, I'm glad I didn't go to the viewing now, because I promised my partner that this was the last one that he'd ever have to go to.
Oh, no. There's three more. There's at least 9 hours of fun. Well, it depends. Depends if it can crack that $1 billion mark.
Wow.
And that's what really matters about cinema and film. Can it crack that $1 billion mark?
Here's one I think. I don't know. Is it safe to say that the first film we're reviewing this week will not crack that? We're talking about Renfield.
Renfield. No, I don't think this is a $1 billion grosser, unfortunately. Although the opening of the Movie Squad theme, it does reference Fast and the Furious, and they say "Salute my familia."
Mm-hmm.
But are you familiar with the concept of a familia? Taylor,
well,
interested. This film follows the side character from the legendary Bram Stoker tale of Dracula, and concerns itself with Renfield. So Here you've got Nicolas Cage playing and fulfilling a dream of playing sort of an impressionistic 30s era horror villain, playing Dracula, Count Dracula, the Transylvanian immortal who thrives and survives on the blood of innocents. The movie focuses on Renfield, who is his familiar, which is something of a semi-hypnotized slave, effectively, tasked, doomed with collecting food, blood, people, innocence for Dracula to feast upon, and has some, you know, powers of immortality, and is often seen sort of snarfing bugs. And I think Tristan, played most memorably by Peter McNichol in Ooh. Dracula Dead and Loving It. Do you have a favourite Renfield from the eras?
That's a good, because he is a consistent character in a lot of the different versions of Dracula. The one I always go to is Tom Waits playing Renfield in Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula.
Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula.
How can we forget? But, you know, it's usually like a side character, and yeah, like, between Tom Waits and Peter McNichol, like someone who's kind of a bit of a creep, a sort of a strange weirdo, someone who's eating bugs and just like, you know, calling for the master. But here it's a different kettle of fish. It's been kind of, I guess, modernized, a recast for this generation.
I thought you were going to say yassified, Tristan.
I leave you two for 2 weeks.
yeah, I blame him, Lucia. The Renfield of this film is played by Nicholas Hoult, who people will hopefully know from The Great and other films,
we'll
the X-Men franchise.
From Skins.
Skins, of course, and even stepping back further. And I think he's maybe taken a few lessons from his About a Boy co-star, Hugh Grant, back when he was a child actor. But he is now this sort of foppish Englishman who just happens to be somewhat undead. He also played a zombie in the movie Warm Bodies, which is actually very funny. But here, Renfield, we're introduced to him. He and Dracula's sort of recuperating from a recent blinding of light and was sort of melted. And now they're recuperating in New Orleans. The specific reason for that, I believe, is because there are tax breaks in New Orleans when you film a movie there. But anyway, we're introduced to him, and while looking for desperate people to feed his master, he winds up in a support group for people in toxic relationships and goes, wait a second, I don't think this Dracula's really a positive influence on my life. And we explore what it's like for Renfield to try and divorce himself from that toxic relationship. Now, Taylor and Tristan, you've both seen this. All three of us have seen this, which is very fortunate. And I'll flag quickly that it is directed by Chris McKay, who made the Lego Batman movie. And it's written by Ryan Ridley, who is a core and key writer of Rick and Morty. And I think that's a good tone setter for what this film strives to be. But I ask you two both this. Why is so much of the movie about a cop played by Awkwafina trying to bring down a drug cartel?
These are the questions, Simon.
I mean, were you thinking about this, Taylor, while you're watching it?
I did think that this plot is a bit ridiculous and thin on the ground. And ooh. I guess they kind of, I don't know, she needs to be there. They need to give her our story. I just don't think it was fully realised.
Yeah, it's a bit off the shelf, which is unfortunate because I was looking forward to this film. I mean, you know, if you're a Nicolas Cage fan, you would have maybe seen the making of photos of him in the ghoulish makeup and a kind of a crushed velvet suit and just kind of feeling like, oh, well, you know, and this is apparently his first like major studio film in quite some time after kind of paying off his debts and sort of being back on a better shape of his career, even though, and what he's the best thing about this film, pretty much. And the thing that he has always got, even when his films have been maybe a bit beneath him or a bit laughable, is 100% commitment. And there's a scene where Dracula confronts Renfield in his apartment that I thought was the funniest scene of the movie. And it was down to Nicolas Cage, what he did with his eyes, what he did with his voice, the way he would, you know, the flourishes he would give certain words. And I just was like, I wish the movie was more like that. But then you've got these scenes where Renfield, like, eats a bug and then suddenly has, like, John Wick powers and, like, you know, eliminates in grotesque martial arts fashions all these assassins and drug dealers. And it feels very familiar. It feels like a lot of films we've just seen recently. So, yeah, I don't know why. And we've got a great improviser, Ben Schwartz, as a drug dealer's son. And I don't know. It really does miss the mark in something that could have been a really fun horror comedy take on the whole Dracula thing.
And I think off the shelf, the subplot here being off the shelf is such a great way to put it, because when I think about Rick and Morty and the Lego Batman movie and the Lego films, and I'm a fan of those things, their whole ethos is you take the thing off the shelf, but it's in a new form. You kind of make it wacky, and that's kind of the joke, is that it's a Dracula movie, but they have to take down a drug cartel. Like, that's meant to be the bit of the film, but it doesn't get there. And whether that's the live action of it all, or whether it's just actually, like you say, Taylor, the script is super thin. And I think the screenplay has to be better than the elevator pitch. And it's just not, right? I like that it was very violent. You know, when the action scenes are happening, and they're not John Wick caliber, they're not up to that scale of impressiveness, right? But the way in which bodies are dismantled is so outlandishly cartoonish and bloody that you kind of just have to laugh a little bit, because it's like, oh, okay, he's torn off two arms and is now using them to spear people. Like, that was amusing to me. But overall, it just feels like they didn't get there with the tone, and the joke doesn't work, even though Nicolas Cage, he's in on the joke, he's very funny. And Nicholas Hoult, I love. He always goes for it and is fun in this mode. Taylor, what did you think about Nicolas Hoult as Renfield, who, as is acknowledged at one point in the film, might be the world's most notorious serial killer, being the rom-com lead of this film?
Yeah, it was interesting. I don't have much sort of context for previous Renfields. I didn't know that was a person.
So you haven't seen Mel Brooks' Dracula, Dead and Loving It?
I've not. I thought that it was a good fit. I really enjoyed watching him, that he was like part pathetic but also part definitely a serial killer. Was an interesting dichotomy. I felt like, and I haven't watched a Nicolas Cage film for a really long time, and I guess I just kind of forgot, he feels like the king of overacting, and I know that's kind of, I get that's the shtick. I was in a viewing of this film, and every single line, like everything that he said, there were laughs, like roarous, like people cacking themselves.
Well, that's so interesting, because I often, the weird thing that I went to after seeing this film is, like, something that Chris Rock used to say about when he would go and test material. And Chris Rock, you know, he goes to a stand-up club in New York or whatever, and it's not an arena. He walks on stage. The crowd loses it. They're loving it. But then after 10 minutes, the jokes have to work. You know, they're not just going to fake laughter or keep laughing. And I agree. I think Nicolas Cage, he works throughout the whole movie, but it's not enough to power. The premise of this film is not enough to power a film. It doesn't get you past that 15-minute mark. And I think it has a very strong opening 5 minutes when they, like, a visually strong 5 minutes. Tristan, yeah, it's 90 minutes long. Were you flagging like me towards the end of Renfield?
Yeah, I was kind of checked out. I mean, and he's actually not in the movie that much. He's probably in a fifth of the movie, and it's more time given over to Awkwafina. And, you know, you say rom-com, there's no chemistry between him and Nicholas Hoult. They just seem like acquaintances who are getting along. And then, you know, you talk about the pedigree of, like, it's from a Rick and Morty writer, but then there are jokes in this where you think, is this a bit, because this already feels like played out or a meme in itself. Like, this is a film that starts with, like, you might be wondering how I got to this place.
Yeah, the record scratch, like, freeze frame, yeah.
And then the jokes of, like, did you just do that? That was weird, or something like that. And it's just like, is this a commentary on the commentary? I have no idea. But anyway, yeah, very disappointing. But then again, I think some people won't be as hard. Maybe they'll just be up for the fun of the kind of the violence and the gags. But yeah, I thought it was a disappointment myself.
And not to evoke it a third time, it's not as good as Dracula, Dead and Loving It, which is truly damning some with faint praise. I also, you know, I'm still waiting for, like, where is the very scary comedy? You know, like, it's not a horror comedy. It's just a very violent comedy. And you mentioned this about Mafia Mama. It may have been off air, Taylor, but a few weeks ago, about how violent that film is.
That film was so violent. I feel like this film was violent, but it was ridiculous, which took the edge off.
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Renfield, in cinemas now.
All right. If you've gone to see this, or if you're going to see this, let us know. 0405-921-921. It is Movie Squad. We'll be back with part two in just a moment. something you don't get to hear on Breakfast very often. But for a good reason, it is Oingo Boingo with No One Lives Forever. Tristan, this is on the radio right now for one reason, one reason only. There's something exciting happening at Luna Leaderville tonight.
Yeah, this is from the soundtrack to a film that Trash Classics is screening this evening, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, which is from 1986, a cult classic sequel to the, you know, legendary horror film. And there is an actual connection because Caroline Williams, who is stars in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, has a small part as a lawyer in Renfield. But yeah, we're screening the film tonight, and it should be a fun. It's R-rated film. It is very violent, but it's also very excessive and very wild, and was also apparently banned in Australia for 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. That's right, Tristan. This movie is really fun. It is. it's a horrifying film, but it's very funny. And yeah, if you want to see a movie that was banned for 20 years in Australia and see why, it'll be there. I'll be there tonight, Tristan.
Oh, wow.
I can't wait.
Thank you.
Do you have to see number one to see number two?
You can drop it. It's not too, like, if you'll get the gist. It's also like a very different film. Like the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a very kind of gritty and intense film. This is intense, but it's also like a big cartoon. Mm. And it also stars Dennis Hopper, and you get to see him wield a chainsaw in a chainsaw duel long before Nicolas Cage did the same thing in Mandy. So
thank you for giving me a very real answer to a very stupid question. We're going to change pace now and talk about our second film this week. Tristan, tell us all about Petrol.
Hey, wait for me. Wait up.
Hey, look at the moon. When I was little, I prayed to go to the moon.
I was more of a sun person myself. I was scared of the dark. I was a scaredy cat. I'm so sorry you dropped us on the street.
Oh my God. That's lucky. Have we met before? You look kind of familiar.
Oh no, don't think so.
Eva was the name of my sister.
Hey, you could stay in that spare room if you wanted.
What if I'm just a mediocrity with nothing to say?
Ой, пожалуйста, не надо драматизировать.
Well, Petrol is also in cinemas this week, and it's a new Australian film from director Alina Lodkina. And I had not seen her previous film that I'd always wanted to. It screened at Revelation a couple of years ago, a film that she made, her first film, Strange Colours, which I finally caught up with. It's on streaming platforms, and I really liked it. It's a family drama set in Lightning Ridge, this opal mining kind of outback town in New South Wales. And I really liked, you know, what was a small budget art house film, what she and her collaborators did. So I was very excited about this new film, Petrol, which in some ways is similar to her previous film and in a lot of ways is different. Now, Simon has also seen this film, but had you... Before you saw this film, were you aware of either Alina Lodkina or knew anything about this film going into it?
No, and I hadn't seen Strange Colours, and this was in a run of films. And Taylor, you haven't been here for the last few weeks, but the latest where I went in completely blind, and I was very glad to have done so.
Yeah.
And it felt like, you know, I know I'm late to the party, but it felt like an exciting discovery for me.
That's exciting to hear because it does feel, you know, in some ways it shares a bit in common with some independent or low-budget Australian films, but it also feels quite different, particularly after reviewing films like last week, Limbo, and the kind of prevalence of like crime movies in Australian cinema or kind of broad comedies. This is something else. Anyway, but it... To give a little bit about what it's about, which is a very difficult task, it's about a film student named Eva, who lives in Nam, Melbourne, played by Natalie Morris, who people will recognise from the TV show Bump, which is on Stan. I was not familiar with the show or her, but she's basically a film student who lives at home. Her and her family have a Russian background, which is similar to the director, who has a Russian background, but this is not autobiographical autobiographical in any way. The first scene of the movie follows Eva as she's basically recording sound on a coastal hillside to use in her latest project for her film class. And while she's doing it, she spies a group of kind of artists making a performance. I think they're filming it. And sees Mia, played by Hannah Lynch. And there's something about her. She's kind of dressed up as a vampire, to tie in with Renfield. But there's a different vibe here. And they don't meet at that point. But later on, while she's walking around the city at night, she sees Mia. She sees Mia and a friend. They're going off to a party, and she follows. And then kind of in that, you know, house party atmosphere, they meet and they become friends. And we kind of chart this sort of strange relationship where Eva is really drawn to Mia, maybe romantically, maybe just in the sense of a friendship where you're trying to work out your own identity and you see someone who's kind of exciting and you think, I'm going to define myself through knowing this person. And it goes into some strange places, and I can talk a little bit more about it, but it's also quite an experience because when I was watching this film, it would unfold and surprise me. There would be moments that were kind of like little surreal jokes and then dream sequences and then strange spectral or kind of supernatural things, but it's not a thriller, it's not a ghost story, it's not a horror movie, but it plays with that a little bit. I guess the best comparison would be to something like the works of David Lynch, in that getting into the existential and the dream subconsciousness. But in a sense, I really like this film and where it took me, and particularly through the performances, the cinematography, and the overall style. I don't know, Simon, is there anything else you can add to try and explain what this film is?
Well, I would counter the idea that it's not a ghost story. I think it is a ghost story, but not in the traditional sense. And that doesn't mean that there's spooky ghosts floating around in this film. But it's about this idea. And, you know, one of the things I'll point to, that opening scene, and like the kind of opening scene that just sucks you in completely. The sound design is so strong and involving and immersive, but it does call to mind Picnic at Hanging Rock. You know, it has that kind of metaphysical, spiritual feel to it. And maybe it's about this impossibility of knowing another person and that mystery, trying to unfold that mystery. Was so, and I'm going to use a word that I don't use often and haven't used since Sofia Coppola's movie The Beguiled. I think this movie is beguiling. it really did just sort of suck me in. And we've talked a lot about, like you mentioned, films that are primarily about tone and texture. We did that with Limbo. We did that with It Is In Us All.
Yeah.
And sometimes they can be a bit too academic. I'm not talking about those films specifically, but movies that are less about narrative, more about just the feel of it. What I liked about Petrol is that it's so deeply felt. So it is a tone piece, but it felt very emotionally involving. And like I said, I was sucked into the mystery of it without trying to pretend that there's some mystery to solve, if that makes sense. Taylor, do any of these very... Tristan and I clearly dancing around the fun and exciting things that happen throughout the movie... Is it something that has beguiled you?
Well, I feel like there's just a wave of calm energy that's come over the studio. I feel mesmerised and a little bit hypnotised as well. There's always something really special and sort of spiritual about Australian cinema. So I am excited to learn more about this interest, and I know that you were lucky enough to actually speak with Elena.
Yeah, and so there's a version of the interview online already through the RTRFM website, but there'll be a longer one on the Movie Squad podcast released later today. And it was great to chat with her. She was in town last night for a Q&A session. And, sometimes it's good when you read an interview or get a sense of what the filmmaker was thinking, because I'm sure that for some people when they see this movie, they might have the opposite reaction of going, like, this is too... abstract or weird or arty. I don't know what's going on. But I think with the way she talked about the film and the way that she approaches the film, it's very open and inviting. And I think you find where you can link up. And to me, it was the sense of this young person trying to define themselves and kind of being on the outside of things. And I think everyone would have that experience of being outside a circle of people and feeling like, I want to be part of this and trying to contribute to a party discussion, but kind of not being heard and sort of being a little bit ignored. And that restlessness of wanting to be part of something, but, you know, in the sense the elusiveness. So anyway, but this is, I think the performances, particularly the lead actor, is really good. She's the kind of perspective of the movie, the cinematography, the music by Mikey Young.
So good.
Yes. Who also scored her previous film. So a lot of great talents come together for this film. Yeah.
This is wonderful. It is Petrol in select cinemas.
Yes, but out in cinemas now. And I think it would be a great film to experience in a cinema because there's a lot of visual, audio, kind of sensational parts to what is a very like unique and low budget but arty Australian movie. Yeah.
All right. That is Movie Squad this week. Petrol and Renfield. Simon, thank you.
Thank you.
Tristan, thank you as well.
Thank you.
You can hear more Movie Squad next Friday. And keep an eye and an ear out for the Movie Squad podcast. It's out later today, and there'll be an extended conversation with the director of Petrol, Elena Lodkina. Folks, thank you. We'll catch up again next week.
Well, there you go. We were talking, or trying to do our best to describe and summarize Petrol without really, it's not in a sense giving it away. It's just that it's hard to get across the experience of watching the film in a sense. But was there like anything else that you wanted to add to your review of Petrol?
Well, I wanted to just follow on from a thing you said towards the end of your review, which is that, you know, we've talked about this a lot, when there are quote-unquote art films, or let's say slightly more, you know, abstract movies, you do have to go and meet them halfway.
Yeah.
You gotta go to the cinema or, you know, if you're watching it at home and say, like, all right, I'm locking in. If I do the two-screen experience here, if I'm flipping around on my phone, I'm not going to get much or anything out of it. But what I loved about Petrol was that it didn't feel like it was closed off to me. And a lot of those films can feel that way, like, you didn't get it, you ain't smart enough.
Mm.
You know, like, you got to really put in the work to get this movie, and if you didn't get it, it's your fault. This wasn't like that. And I think it's partly because, you know, and it's so hard to, you know, it's ephemeral, right? It's hard to describe, like you say. But I felt like there was so much space in this movie to put myself in it, to not necessarily as a character or trying to identify, but to just kind of live in the film and go, okay, what's going on here? You know, and what is this about? Does that matter? You know, is it more about that emotional, that sort of like that primal feeling? And maybe it's a filmmaker trying to convey something that can't be put into words. Mm. And that's why there's no strict narrative that we can just rattle off here. But I enjoyed that, you know, and I think the interview that people will hear the extended version of now really articulates that open space that's available for people to come and play in as opposed to be closed off from.
Yeah, and it's like the film itself is not like abstract and surreal from the start to the end. Like there are scenes of kind of very relatable, you know, her walking with her mother, just talking about university or, you know, going out to a party, things like that you can hold on to and recognize. And then there'll be a moment, a little flourish or a kind of an image, and you're just like, whoa, what? And there's no sense of trying to give you an explanation or a context. And it is definitely one of those experiences where you just sort of, you go with the flow. You just like don't resist, you know, and that's probably the best way to watch it. But, you know, and I'm sure, you know, the filmmaker understands that there would be resistance, but that's like, I think, you know, part of the joy to celebrate a film like this is that, you know, we want all types of films. We just don't want a film that's trying to appease everyone. And, you know, Renfield is a little bit like that, even though it's being very violent and you know, probably wouldn't be for everyone, but it does feel very, you know, for the masses. Whereas this film, you know, if you click with it, it will really make an impact.
And I don't think it's alienating. We've mentioned words like surreal, but I like the word like metaphysical for it. And they do talk about, you know, look, the words quantum entanglement are mentioned, right?
Yes.
But once and that's it. But there is an element of, you know, they define it as like spooky coincidences.
Yes.
And there's a lot of spooky coincidences in the film. And once that specter is raised, then when it happens throughout the movie, I wasn't expecting them, but I was like, right, this is the energy we're working with in this film. And I like that Taylor said that there was this calm sort of wash over the studio as we were talking about it, because I think there are some unnerving and unsettling moments in the movie.
Yeah.
But I felt very like, okay, my heartbeat has just slowed. My breathing has calmed and I'm just sort of getting sucked into it. So I hope I, and I think you have, have conveyed, that this is a movie that, you know, kind of, you know, you come to the party, but then it takes you on a journey. And I really like that about Petrol.
Yes. And so we're going to throw to in a moment, but it was great to sit down and talk to the director, Elena Lotkina, about the film. And just starting off from the very basic question, what is the meaning behind the title Petrol?
Yeah, it's a great probably question to start off with, because I should clarify for anyone who hasn't heard about the film that it's a very lateral title, and the film doesn't really have anything to do with cars. It's a film about a friendship between two young women, and is a kind of meditative, surrealistic journey into youthful discovery and imagination and your 20s in Melbourne and getting lost and finding yourself. But, it, you know, it's a very a kind of sprawling in some way narrative that, you know, is a portrait of a time and a place and a time in one's life. And the title is, well, first of all, I think is a clue to not take things at face value as you walk into the film. And, you know, you kind of, you have this title in the back of your mind, but you walk in, you very quickly realize that the film is not really that. So my intention was that, you know, I'm asking audiences to start thinking laterally and making associations and start thinking, why is it called that and why is this happening? And there's no straight answers. It's a film that I hope invites people to make their own associations and conclusions, and hopefully it opens up questions. For me, Petrol is, you know, I think of a spilt pool of petrol on the ground, you know, the kind of rainbow colours that it makes as it refracts light. And that is this, that kind of image that is, you know, it's quite beautiful, but it's also something menacing and kind of volatile about it. And it's this kind of image that you come across in any city in the world, and this is very much about urban life and, you know, in some ways anxieties and pressures of urban life as well for young people. So that's just, yeah, that's one of the clues.
Fantastic. Well, on that point, I mean, yeah, the film, Petrol, focuses on a film school student, Eva, played by Nathalie Morris, and the relationship that develops with an artist named Mia, played by Hannah Lynch. You were talking a little bit about it before. Why did you want to focus on young people for your story?
One of the themes in the film is vulnerability and the kind of blurred line between self and others. And I think that in your kind of time, in your 20s, in this youthful time where you're, from my impression, perhaps quite open to the world. Maybe as we go through life, we lose a little bit of that, or risk losing a bit of that openness. And I was interested in that openness, and as a kind of exploration of how we relate to others. And how we can get confused, I think, about what we are when we come up against others. And it's a film about a friendship, and it is a very romantic friendship, even if it is in the end platonic. But there's something very charged and mysterious about this relationship between these two girls. And I think that, you know, it's about that kind of push and pull of what you want to be and what the other person presents and what you project onto them, and the kind of madness that can ensue, I think, in these And it's a very volatile relationship that involves a lot of push and pull between the two, with the Mia's character is this sort of elusive point of fascination for the protagonist. And as the story unfolds, she kind of pulls away and disappears and, confuses things. And, yeah, I think that I was interested in this kind of relationship as and this time in people's life, to explore these themes of identity, ultimately. Also, I think that, the traditional coming-of-age films tend to have certain concerns, socio-political themes or whatever that are often explored, and I don't always see the kind of existential things that I think are also a big part of life at any point in your life, and that's what interested in me and the kind of philosophical questions.
Yeah, and alongside that kind of philosophical and existential quality, I mean, the film is very unique and strange, and it caught me off guard in moments of surrealism and dream imagery. How did you approach conveying this imaginative quality without, I guess, going too far?
Yeah, it's a big challenge. I think I tried to balance everyday elements and a very gentle story unfolding around Eva's family life, her life at university, her friends that kind of surround her, and very normal, banal scenes of, shopping with her mother or whatever, eating at home, just normal little things peppered with kind of imaginative flourishes. But I guess my approach was trying to, in a way, collapse the world of imagination and reality into one plane where everything kind of existed as like the same, on the same, on a level playing field. And, often when you dream, your dreams are so normal, but something about them is a bit off. So I try to treat the dream-like elements as normal and not make a point of them. So everything just was sort of casual. That was kind of my cinematic approach.
Well, it adds such a charged element at moments, because sometimes these moments are very charming, and then other times they're almost disturbing. And there were moments when I was watching the film thinking, is this going to turn into maybe a horror film? Is this a thriller? Is this a romance? So I really enjoyed the collapse, as you say, and that it sort of touched on different genres. But I would say that this film, there's not a clear genre in my view of it, and that it was very kind of, hard to categorize in a way, which I think is one of its, one of the things that's brilliant about it. Can we talk about the actors? Natalie Morris is the film's focus, and her character is the perspective of the movie. And as you were talking about, the character of Mia, played by Hannah Lynch, is the kind of elusive figure that she becomes obsessed with. How did you come to cast these two actors, and what do you think they added to the roles?
They were such incredible actresses to work with, and they really make the film what it is. Natalie was the person who came through first, just through the traditional casting process. She auditioned actually for the role of Mia, and when I saw her, just to add to the kind of mixed identity theme, when I saw her tape, I just thought, she's really great, but I think she'd probably be more appropriate for the role, for the main role. And then when we invited her to audition for the main role, it turns out that that's actually the role that she really wanted to do, and that resonated with her. And she'd already taped for it, and so they sent us that tape, and we cast her almost right away. And then we were casting for Mia for a little while, and finally I was chatting to Natalie about whether she knew anyone or had any suggestions, and she put forward her friend Hannah Lynch, and Hannah is a New Zealander, and they actually studied together in Wellington at the famous drama school there. And so it was, yeah, it was like a big risk for us to get Hannah out during the pandemic.
Right, yes.
Because of, you know, all the various things we had to deal with, obviously, with that. But we wanted to take the risk because not only did we fall in love with Hannah from her, she taped for it and was she was perfect, but also I loved the fact that they had this pre-existing friendship, and I think that brought a lot into the film as well, and, you know, made the rehearsal process really fun and interesting because they had this kind of energy between them. I think they're some of the most interesting actors working in Australia. Well, Natalie's working in Australia and Hannah in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And I hope, yeah, we see a lot more of them. Probably your audience, your listeners tonight might be familiar with Natalie from her work on the show Bump.
Right,
which is
yes, on
Stan.
Yeah.
So she plays the lead on that.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, well, I think it's a great, you know, two really great performances, particularly Natalie, because she is the sort of the central focus and how we understand everything through her kind of reactions and just particularly the feeling that I think it captures when you really want to inject yourself into maybe a social group or want to kind of feel like you belong and people that you might admire kind of almost being on the outside of things in a way was one thing I took from it. With the film Petrol, it's specifically a NAM Melbourne film, and its focus. You mentioning before, it's an urban film. It's a film that's focused on the inner city, but then it also takes in natural landscapes in some of the contrasts. Why did you want the film to highlight this area specifically and this environment?
Well, I moved to Melbourne NAM in 2012, and so it was kind of formative that I lived in the inner city, and it was kind of formative in my 20s, I guess, and formative in my formation as a filmmaker as well, because I went to university in Sydney, but I got involved in the filmmaking community when I moved. And I think that the city, I mean, every city in the country has like its own feel and its own culture and its own history. And I think that Melbourne is, yeah, it's, I mean, it's hard. Like, I think I, it's almost like you want to film a city to understand it and to understand the kind of changing nature and the changing culture and the light and the architecture and all these different elements. So I guess it was a desire to see it in a cinematic way. And it's also a big challenge, I think, for filmmakers in Australia to film in cities,
yes,
both, you know, logistically and aesthetically, and it's, you know, it's not done so much. So I think it's both challenging and exciting because you're kind of looking for different ways of looking at places.
Yeah. Like, I have to say that there's a shot in there of, and, you know, forgive me, I don't know the area or the particular, but where two characters are kind of talking in a park, and in the background are there sort of the lit buildings of the city. And it's such a, I think, almost like a magical otherworldly shot. And it's fascinating. And I think, you know, the way that kind of Australian filmmakers, you know, approach cities, sometimes it can, you know, err on the side of functional or just, you know, you're just capturing things. But I feel like it captures something, but also conveys, something more or something.
Well, I think I have a very romantic kind of outlook, I guess, on life and cinematically especially, and I think that I definitely spoke to a crew about working to achieve that kind of feeling of romance through the images, and in the way that we looked. We put great care into looking for locations. I was so lucky. I worked with a tremendously talented team. And, of course, the cinematographer Michael Latham brought a lot to how that comes across. And everyone is, I think most of our key, I think most of our crew were Victorian, probably everyone. So everyone had something to bring and something that they understood about the city and that life and contributed. But it's also in the colour schemes and the clothes and interiors and, you know, the production designer Leah Popple is, you know, one of the really exciting Australian production designers working today, and she brought her particular eye to the film as well. So, yeah, it's made up of a lot of elements.
Fantastic. Well, one thing is that in preparation for Petrol, I finally saw your previous film, Strange Colours, which I'd always been meaning to watch, and I watched it. It was on SBS On Demand and I think a few other streaming services. And that's quite a different film in its setting, in that it's kind of Lightning Ridge, the sort of the countryside, the sort of disconnected, and this is a film that's about the city space. But in terms of going from one film to another, like, what did you learn on Strange Colours that you applied to Petrol?
Between the two films, we had quite a bit of a jump in budget. You know, Petrol, we had a much bigger budget and more resources as a result. But as, you know, all filmmakers always say, when your budget increases, your resources don't actually increase proportionately to that. Like, you're kind of still struggling to make ends meet. So I think that, yeah, despite seemingly having more budget to play around with, we still had to be very... Also, Strange Colours was shot on a micro budget of, you know, almost very, very, like, just enough to cover the costs. So we had to learn to be very resourceful and work with a small team. And we took that methodology to Petrol, despite the fact that we could afford a little bit more. And I think our crew was almost 15 people on Strange Colours and maybe 30 people on Petrol. Wow. So, you know, quite a bit more, but still small. I also worked with almost all the same, very similar lead heads of department on both films, which is, a real joy for me to have, such talented collaborators. And one thing that I learned that is different is just how hard it is to shoot in the city, you know. I really wanted to make a film where I lived and a place where I understood, because Strange Colours was very removed from my experience, and I, you know, involved a lot of research and a lot of quite strenuous trips and a lot of time put into understanding that place that was so far from my life. And after that, I really wanted to do something close to home and with, you know, that I knew and understood intimately. But it was really challenging just moving cast and crew around the city.
Yeah.
Sometimes during traffic, losing lots of time, losing lots of resources on parking and things like that.
Right, yeah.
Not to even begin talking about noise pollution.
Oh,
and,
no.
You know, we had a very talented sound recorder, Steve Bond, who kind of rescued the film on a number of occasions. But I don't even know how, like, the wizardry that he put into that to get that location sound, which was often, like a nightmare.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I understood in that, from that experience, why Australian filmmakers shoot in the outback, because you just, you know, pull up your SUV or whatever, wherever you want, and no parking, no sound, pollution. You just, you know, shoot whenever you want, whatever you want.
Yeah.
No OH&S, well, you know, OH&S, sure, but no, like, traffic controllers or whatever.
That's very interesting to hear, because sometimes, I guess, with a lot of media, sort of take for granted, oh, you know, you can just film. But, yeah, everything that you have to control to even just make a small scene shot in the, you know, on the street work and be protected from the elements.
Permits, yeah.
Yes. I had a general question about, you know, it feels like there's lots of media out there these days, but I'm sure for a lot of people who are eager to be involved in filmmaking or to direct a movie, it might feel like it's hard to make a film anywhere, and particularly in Australia. What would your advice be to anyone who's interested in either pursuing filmmaking or being a director?
I think it is very hard. I think maybe my best advice, and you know, I've been very fortunate to make two films, but I'm still figuring it out and often feel like an amateur in some ways. You know, and I've been independent, and I don't always feel like I'm kind of employed in the industry, you know, every time with every project, it's like a big push to get something off the ground. But I think my best advice from my, and maybe this is romantic or idealistic, but I've kind of been, it's been helpful for me to have something about the process that you love and focus on that. Other than have something about the work that will get you through, that is more, I guess, more powerful than whatever might come with the end result that you wish. Mm. I think that we tend to focus on the end result and the kind of recognition, approval, or whatever it is, you know, that I think all creative people obviously desire and need to sustain themselves. But I think that if you find something that sustains you, that is in the work and in the process, like learning about life or being connected through to things that you love, through culture and through images and through through the work, I think that's really helpful because otherwise the kind of various disappointments and challenges and the time might start to seem very, like, unbearable.
Right.
Well, I think for, you know, I think that a lot of people struggle in film because things take so much time and so much resources. And, you know, you might not get the easy reward right away. You really have to believe in it. And find something private that kind of keeps you working.
Sorry, that's really interesting as well, because I think that's an aspect too, Petrol, in that, you know, it's about a film student, and there are moments where they're either in class or receiving kind of advice, and it feels like at moments the film is sort of internalizing or in conversation with or in dialogue with some of those ideas and what you're saying about the process and just making something as well. RTR, as we have a lot of music fans, and definitely Mikey Young is someone that a lot of people know through different bands like Eddie, current Suppression Ring, Total Control, and the fact that he's seems to be the person who masters most independent artist releases. He scored your previous film, Strange Colors, and he scores it alongside Raven Mahon for Petrol. How did you become involved with these musicians to score your films?
I actually got introduced to those guys by a very talented music supervisor that I worked with at first on Strange Colors and then on Petrol again, whose name is Gemma Burns. And she's really, she's like really coming up in that scene. She actually just did the new Ari Aster film as a music supervisor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so on Strange Colors, I've known Gemma through friends for some time, so we were really lucky to work with her on Strange Colors, and she put forward Mikey. He'd scored another Australian independent film called The Mule, which some of listeners might be familiar with, and so he had a bit of that experience already, and was just he's such a talented and versatile musician, but also understood the time frames and the kind of professionalism that is involved in collaborating with filmmakers, because of course we're very tight for time and we need it's really tight turnarounds. So that was like a big very encouraging working with him, and he brought on Raven and a bunch of other musicians on Strange Colors, and then Raven and him continued the collaboration on Petrol, and we did a short film in between that they did music for called Mercury, which is online somewhere.
Okay.
But they just improvised like some fun music for that. But yeah, like it's they are just so much fun to work with, and it's like a really enjoyable part for me of the process. Working with them during the edit on Petrol, because we did have the film was funded, so properly funded in Australia, so we had more resources on the post-production side of things. So we had an opportunity to work with an orchestra through a Melbourne collective called New Market Studios, and they work with really brilliant classical musicians. So we had a day at the studio where musicians came in and recorded tracks, and they were properly arranged. And we had the idea that because the film also features a lot of local music that Gemma unearthed from artists like Makeda and Wiley Hui, and Sweet World did an original track actually, a bunch of others. So it has like this very electronic feel, so that's like the music playing at party scenes. Yes. And I'm actually so proud of that. Like, I think it's a really exciting collection of music that we pulled together for the film, and an exciting kind of aspect of the film. But in contrast, Mikey and Raven's score has a kind of more organic, a romantic, gentle sound that, is not immediately in the world of the film. It's a bit outside, and I think frames the film really nicely, plays into that romantic element and almost like old-fashioned. Probably influences of Debussy or something like that in there.
Well, I really appreciate your time once again. And just this is the final question, because, the film is opening in cinemas. I know that it's been playing in a few other states. With it going into wider release, how have you found people's reactions to the film Petrol? Have there been any surprising interpretations?
One of the joys with the film that is so open is you always get some really interesting interpretations. And I'm always surprised, actually, that often it's, the main themes come across really strongly and people really get into the film on its own terms, which is very rewarding for me as a filmmaker. But also, have interesting things they notice, or that, I feel like every time it's a little bit different. That's what I love about the opportunity to show the film in cinemas and, have the discussions with the audiences after, because the energies are always a bit different and they shift, and I think different things seem to stand out at different screenings. Like, the discussions kind of end up focusing on one element or the other, and that's kind of a whole other different interesting aspect of film's life, is how it carries on in, you know, without you, and how people, how it lives in people's minds and hearts afterwards. But yeah, it's, you know, definitely there's a bit of a difference showing the film internationally and locally. You know, here I think people are interested in how our cities are filmed and, you know, how we approach locations and why we chose to kind of portray, you know, local kind of concerns. But I think maybe internationally it seemed like people had, yeah, different things stood out, or they asked, yeah, about different things. But it's hard to explain, really. It's very much in the feeling of the room.
Yeah.
Very unpredictable, you know, and some, it's not a film for everyone as well. So, yeah, sometimes people find it, yeah, uncomfortable or disturbing because it's sort of, it's so open. But I've also been rewarded because I often get people writing to me saying they've, you know, a few days passed and they're still thinking about the film, which is, that is just the best thing. That's the thing you want to hear as a filmmaker. It's the best feedback.
Of course. I mean, you spent so long making something that you feel that, you know, the shelf life or the after effect of the movie is not just like, yeah, you know, you leave the cinema and don't think about it. And I think definitely Petrol. And then also I think Strange Colors were both films I was still thinking about days after seeing them. So, yeah, congratulations once again on Petrol. And it was really great to talk to you about it and, you know, understand it a bit more as well.
Thank you so much for having me, Tristan. And thank you for your time.